This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The World Series that ended on Wednesday night with part two of a game that had been suspended in the rain on Monday was unprecedented for that reason. It was also unusual because it was the win that gave the World Series title to the Philadelphia Phillies. The Phils hadn't won the series since 1980. Before that, they hadn't won since, they hadn't won. And this is no expansion team we're talking about. The Phillies have been at it for 126 years.
Phillies are world champions.
A moment after that last out was recorded on Wednesday night, Brad Lidge, the relief pitcher with 48 saves who didn't blow a single opportunity all season and was on the mound for the historic moment, fell to his knees. His teammates rushed him and buried him in what has become the obligatory pig pile. Very shortly thereafter, the celebration beyond the ballpark began. The regrettable elements of that celebration included trash fires, overturned cars, and arrests. On Friday afternoon, an estimated 2 million Phillies fans turned out for the official victory parade. Reporter Joel Rose was there.
The streets around City Hall were a sea of red Phillies shirts as thousands of fans played hooky to witness the city's first victory parade in a generation. Most of them didn't get anywhere near the actual parade. To do that, you actually had to show up early, like Ron McCorkle and Leslie Baxter. They made the trip all the way from Ephrata, Pennsylvania, about 70 miles west of Philly.
We got down here about 9:30 this morning.
Yeah, 9:30 this morning we got here.
McCorkle and Baxter say they never lost faith in this team, although Baxter admits she did get a little worried during the two-day layover in the middle of Game 5.
I wasn't nervous. I was more like antsy, you know, like, come on, get back in there. You know you're going to win it. Let's just get in and do it.
We were in Tampa Bay's head. They just got off a hard series with Boston. They were exhausted, and the only thing I was worried about, it may let them get their win back. But when I saw that stadium, when they started that game and saw how many fans got back in that ballpark, I knew there was no way Tampa was going back to Tampa with another win. It was over. Done.
The win is just the second championship in 125 years of baseball for the Phillies. The team has lost more than 10,000 games, easily the most in baseball history. They made the playoffs last year for the first time since 1993, but they were quickly swept by the Colorado Rockies. For all that, fans like Kobe Dawkins never quite gave up on the Phillies.
I believed in them. I wasn't sure how far they'd get. I was pretty sure they'd win the division and make it into the playoffs after that. It's a crapshoot, so you never know. But they played great and deserved it.
Dawkins is self-employed, so he didn't have to play hooky to watch the parade. But it's clear that a large percentage of the crowd was supposed to be somewhere else. That was the case with these junior high kids from Springfield, Pennsylvania.
Oh, no, we completely skipped school.
Do your parents have any idea?
They have no idea.
No idea.
No idea at all.
We told them we were all going to school. We just took the train down here for the day.
Plenty of grown-ups were playing hooky, too.
Are we at work right now? Are you interviewing me at work? Okay, so you don't say anything to anybody, all right?
Khalil Hamilton of West Philadelphia says he believed in the team all year.
Beyond the skill and the talent, I just really felt that it was our time.
How does it feel seeing all these fans downtown?
I've never seen it in my life. It's crazy. It's nuts. It's beautiful. It's nice. And I haven't seen any violence other than the one nasty hot dog vendor that we had. But other than that, it's been a peaceful, peaceful day.
Some downtown offices didn't even make a pretense of staying open. Jerry Marks is a partner at a Philadelphia law firm.
We don't know what it is, but there's been a revolt in our office, and people have just kind of left.
You brought your own step stool out here, I see.
Because I used to be 5'8". I'm shrinking now, and I'm about 5'7" now. The testosterone is leaving, and I need something to stand on.
Do you think anybody downtown is getting any work done today?
No. But it's good. I think it's healthy and fun, and hopefully the people don't act like idiots, and we'll get through this, and it's a great day.
Not everyone took the day off to watch the parade. Bobby Carter took a break from sorting mail to watch on his lunch hour. Carter had his video camera out, and he was filming the crowd in front of City Hall.
Because this is history. We might not be around to see this again.
Spoken like a true Philly fan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
When your city goes 25 years between victory parades, you can't be too careful. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia. Woo!
Experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. It's a rain delay. It's a rain delay. It's a rain delay. I'm sorry, okay. It would be silly to regard an NBA game played during the first week of the season as significant, let alone crucial, but don't you think fans of the Cleveland Cavaliers would have categorized their team's initial outing that way if the Cavs had beaten the defending champion Boston Celtics on Tuesday night? That seems to me the sort of question Kevin Hench, who writes about the NBA, among other things, for FoxSports.com, might want to consider as we preview the very large portion of the 08-09 season yet to be played. He joins me now on the line. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
The Cavaliers were eliminated by the Celtics in the Eastern Conference semis. They were also defeated by Boston in that season opener to which I just referred. Is the theory that LeBron James is so good he can single-handedly carry his team to an NBA title a theory that should be abandoned by fans, NBA promotions, and the Cavaliers themselves?
Of course. There's no player that's ever been that good. Even Michael Jordan needed a little help with his running mate Scottie Pippen, and LeBron James doesn't have anybody as good as Scottie Pippen on that roster. I think the Cavs were very excited about the acquisition of Mo Williams, which I think is a huge upgrade for them and will help them get to the finals, not to tip my hand, where I do think they'll end up this year. But, yeah, it was probably a little splash of cold water on opening night for Cavalier fans to see their team falling just short in Boston again.
Yeah, we've got a lot of things to talk about before we get to your prediction, so don't tip your hand quite yet, Kevin.
All right.
The defending champion Celtics lost James Posey, key contributor in the offseason. Did their offseason moves leave them in a good position to defend the title?
Well, the nucleus is there, and they're good. They're 1 year older, 1 year wiser. I do think the loss of Posey is a big loss, a bigger loss than you would ever know on the stat sheet. I watched James Posey Wednesday night playing against the Golden State Warriors, and it was a very close game down the stretch, and then Posey went on Steven Jackson for the last few minutes, and Steven Jackson missed his last seven shots. Mm. And that's the kind of lockdown defender that's very hard to find in the NBA. So I think the Celtics will miss James Posey. They're in good shape. I think they are the favorite to come out of the East, but I'm not sure they will.
Many observers think that, along with Cleveland, Toronto and Philadelphia have improved significantly. Will either of those Eastern Conference teams make any kind of a serious bid for the finals?
I like the Raptors a lot. I love Jose Calderon at the point, and Jermaine O'Neal looks fairly healthy, and that's a big, big if. But if he's healthy, I think they will be a contender in the East. The team that I think is being a little overrated in terms of turning it around is the Sixers. I think Elton Brand is deep into the decline phase of his career, and if Sixer fans think he's going to be the key to a successful playoff run, I think they'll be in for a rude awakening.
In the West, the Lakers hope that the return of fully healed center Andrew Bynum will get them back into the finals and maybe help them win the championship. Is the winning formula that simple in Los Angeles?
Well, when you come within two games of winning a title and then add the best young center in the game, I think that's a winning formula. I think the Lakers are in great shape. Obviously, they have the best player on the planet in Kobe Bryant right now, and he seems to have started the season not looking tired from his Olympic odyssey. They look great. I know the poor Clippers thought they might have some hope this year, and that was defeated early with a 30-plus point loss against the Lakers. So I think the Lakers will be in good shape, and again, not to tip my hand, but I think they'll be there in the finals.
The hand is completely tipped. I mean, there's no poker face here at all.
Well, how am I supposed to handicap the Lakers without saying where I think they're going to end up?
All right, moving right along. Portland once had a potential dynasty thwarted by the loud snapping sound of Bill Walton's breaking navicular bone during a game back in 1978, and now center Greg Oden is out for 2 to 4 weeks. They hope it's no longer with a sprained foot. Does this spell more bad luck for Portland's title chances?
I just shook my head the other night when I saw Odin go down, and I had that same feeling you just mentioned, that Bill Walton flashback. You know, here's the guy who had a serious wrist injury and then a serious knee injury and now a semi-serious, possibly, ankle injury. It's going to put him out for as long as a month. And I think he's the key if they're going to be a serious contender. And until he can play 30 consecutive games of NBA basketball, I don't think that team has a lot of hope in the Western Conference.
All right, Kevin, I have to ask you about the dogs. Do they bark when they agree with what you're saying, or are they barking to say you're full of bananas?
That's my dog pound. They got my back. That's for emphasis.
People must forget that New Orleans was the fourth best team in the league last season, because there's not a lot of talk about that team this time around, but they've added the aforementioned James Posey to the mix this year. Will his versatile presence be enough for the Hornets to bring the coveted Larry O'Brien trophy to the Big Easy?
I don't think so. Not quite. I still think that team is a little thin. I love Chris Paul. David West is excellent. Tyson Chandler's a great rebounder. But I'm not sure James Posey is enough to get them by a team that just added, essentially, Andrew Bynum. Although I will say the Lakers will not be happy to see more of James Posey this time in the Western Conference Finals.
All right, well, this is the time in the conversation when I would normally ask you for predictions, but I already know. It's Lakers-Cavaliers in the finals, and the Lakers win, right?
Well, this is how we reward our astute listeners, because they get to piece together the conversation. Yes, I like the Cavaliers over the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals and the Lakers over the Hornets in the Western Conference Finals, which will give us Kobe Bryant versus LeBron James in a David Stern fantasy in the finals, and then the Lakers over the Cavs in six.
Kevin Hinch covers the NBA and many other sports for FoxSports.com. Kevin, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill. Talk to you soon.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Athletic teams representing the University of Minnesota may or may not win renown this season, but a team of 60 apparently competitive people there has already set a record for number of flu shots dispensed on a single day. According to the documents, the energetic 60 will submit to the Guinness Book of World Records. They stuck 11,538 willing patients in one arm or the other on Tuesday at four locations around the campus in Minneapolis and St. Paul. 11,538. The old record of 3,271 flu shots dispensed in a day was set by a team of apparently half-hearted or lazy do-gooders in Sanford, Florida, 2 years ago. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, putting one foot in front of the other for 26.2 miles, sometimes very quickly, in New York City. But first, lots of baseball fans, like lots of people who aren't baseball fans, have been watching their retirement accounts shrink lately. But over the past 2 weeks, baseball fans determined to attend the recently completed World Series encountered some good economic news, or so says Sean Pate, the head of corporate communications for an online outfit called StubHub, a company that matches ticket sellers with potential ticket buyers. When we spoke on Wednesday, he discussed one difference between the 07 World Series, in which the Colorado Rockies played the Red Sox, and this fall's event.
If you compare Colorado and Tampa Bay, where tickets in Colorado last year averaged about $950, this year in Tampa Bay, as of today, the tickets have averaged about $380. And that's a comparative of two new baseball markets that had been in the World Series for the very first time. So I think therein lies a lot of the difference in the market condition.
Current conditions may have created a buyer's market in World Series tickets this fall. Elsewhere in the sports world, those conditions have inspired the same sort of caution and cuts that have been evident in businesses of all kinds. Andrew Zimbalist, the Smith College professor and author who's been writing about the economics of sports for years, points out that even the most prosperous of the pro leagues, the NBA, for example, are seeking ways to economize.
We know already that David Stern, who tends to be an aggressive and forward-looking commissioner, has reduced his staff, the front office staff in the commissioner's office, by 9%. Lots of teams are putting out special deals. The Nets have put out a deal where you can buy now and pay later, which is kind of ironic since that's what got us into the mess in the first place.
Those New Jersey Nets, the basketball team that had planned to move to a new arena in Brooklyn, also postponed the construction of that arena. When the NFL exported a game to London last weekend, the league sent a much smaller entourage than originally planned, according to Andrew Zimbalist, who thinks the NFL and the NBA may lack some of the advantages Major League Baseball has in hard times.
Baseball is somewhat insulated, both because they're at the very end of their season and because they have a television contract that goes all the way to 2013. Coming up, I think we might see a very substantial impact on the New Women's Soccer League, WPS, which, of course, last started back in 2001 when we had our last recession. That was called something else, but it was the Women's Soccer League.
That league was called the WUSA, and it suspended operations in 2003 after just three seasons. It's hard to imagine a worse time for women's pro soccer to try to begin again, this time as the WPS, unless you're the commissioner of the new league, Tanya Antonucci.
We're an affordable sports product, accessible not only to families, but to anyone who's looking for an alternative to maybe some of the more established name brand leagues that are expensive to attend, maybe take the family to in person.
The WUSA failed in 2003 because the national corporate sponsors the league needed never materialized. Tanya Antonucci says the new league, which has more modest expectations and a lower payroll than the WUSA, has an apparel deal lined up. Beyond that, it sounds as if the economic climate has presented her with some challenges.
Normally, national sponsorships close around the September-October timeframe. Those are pushed back into later in the year, and we all need to sit tight and be patient as those issues begin to resolve themselves.
The problem is that nobody knows when those resolutions will begin, let alone when they will inspire potential corporate partners to begin investing in something as potentially fragile as a soccer league that suspended operations in its first incarnation. And some of the international corporations with a history of sponsoring sports franchises are no longer in that business, or in any business. The men of Manchester United's mighty soccer team are still running around in jerseys that say AIG on the front, but what exactly is AIG these days? The pro hockey and basketball teams in Philadelphia play in the Wachovia Center, which might have become the Citigroup Center, except that another company beat Citigroup to the punch in acquiring the remnants of Wachovia. So maybe it'll be the Wells Fargo Arena. The flip side of the downturn may be that corporations that are healthy can find some advertising bargains in the world of sport. At least that's the way Tom Lynn reads the current economy. Lynn is the assistant general manager of the NHL's Minnesota Wild and the general manager of the Wild's minor league affiliate, the Houston Aeros. He says potential sponsors ought to be looking at the current climate not as a disaster, but as an opportunity.
There's people out there buying up foreclosed homes right now. Why is that? Because they can. You know, buying a $200,000 home for $60,000 right now is a good idea. If you can hold it for 5 years, you're going to be in a good position. So companies with the wherewithal and the knowledge to say, we should stick with things that give us value right now and keep our brand positive and keep our relationships. When we get through this, we'll be ahead of the competitors. That's the people you want to appeal to.
Whether those people respond to the appeal is the question. Certainly pro franchises can't be sure that stadium naming rights will continue to be the bonanza they were before some of the names began changing or disappearing. According to Andrew Zimbalist, that was a bonanza upon which some teams had learned to depend.
One of the things that's happened in professional sports since the early 1990s is that the arenas and the stadiums have been gentrified. There's much more catering to the upper-income clientele, to the business groups, selling luxury boxes, club seats. Once you get those people into the ballpark, the signage value goes up, sponsorships go up. And it's precisely those high-income sectors in the large markets that are being hardest hit with the financial collapse in the country.
If the high-income sectors in the large markets are in for hard times, will the middle-income sectors in the small markets fare better? Don Radebaugh, Public Relations and Media Director for ARCA, the Automobile Racing Club of America, a kind of Midwestern minor league for NASCAR, bravely maintains that's the case, since he's seen no decrease in the number of vehicles lined up to start races.
Our car counts remain strong, solid, and constant throughout. Now, I would say that grandstand attendance was down a little in some places, but in other places, it was up. So on the average there, we very much held our own. So as the economy, I hate to use the word crumbled around us, we did not notice it so much. I'm not saying it's not more challenging to go out and get sponsors right now. It is.
The challenge is unlikely to get much easier anytime soon. And even as the more optimistic representatives of franchises, major and minor, in markets large and small, continue to claim that their products are uniquely attractive to fans and sponsors, the optimism will be harder to sustain if more of the fans upon whom they depend lose their jobs, and if the corporations advertising in their venues and their programs keep contracting or disappearing. Whatever happens to the economy, probably nobody should worry about the six minor league teams run by baseball entrepreneur extraordinaire Mike Vec, father of the Disco Demolition Night and son of Bill Vec, the only major league owner ever to send a midget to the plate. I spoke to Mike Vec this week and asked him what advice he would give other owners of minor league teams.
The first thing is, keep your prices in line. Keep them the same as they were last year. Provide one night for free for fans. But most importantly, understand that we're all in this together and that taking care of people has always been the mantra of minor league baseball, knowing our fans, knowing their names, knowing their families. And I think it'll be very smooth sailing for operators who do that.
You, of course, are known somewhat for the imagination that you've demonstrated in some of your promotions. I'm wondering if there's, you know, bankers get in for free day on the horizon, or maybe stockbrokers who can show that they've already applied for unemployment get in for free, something like that?
Funny that you mention that, because, of course, we did Enron night years ago in Portland and took a little heat, but I like to think that we were foreshadowing, prognosticating. But I do think that people who have lost a job, you know, I worked for four major league teams. That was in the past tense. I lost a bunch of jobs. I know how that feels. And I think that all of your listeners and all of the folks in this country know that. So to have a night for people who are not working, you know, between engagements, there's a perfect way to couch it.
I like it.
You know, if you're between engagements, wander out to the ballpark and we'll let you in, no questions asked. If you did that at the major league level, of course, someone would say, how do you know? And we'd have to answer and say, imagine this, we trust people to tell us. And between engagements works, you know, on several levels. You can have, like, the young woman from Georgia who split, you know, on her marriage. So between engagements can mean a lot of things to different people.
Mike Vec is president and part owner of six minor league baseball teams. He's the author of Fun is Good, How to Create Joy and Passion in Your Workplace. Mike, thanks very much for speaking with me.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
As our listeners know, I'm not the most tech-savvy guy, and I'm still struggling with the definition of the podcast, so I'll once again consult the dictionary. Pod, a somewhat elongated two-valved seed vessel, as that of a pea or bean. Cast, to throw or set aside, discard or reject. So if you'd like to discard peas or reject beans, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Tomorrow, too many runners to count without getting really dizzy will run the New York Marathon, the 26.2-mile race that crosses five bridges while winding through the city's five boroughs. Since it was first run in 1970, the race has attracted an increasing number of competitors, participants, and spectators, a circumstance that no doubt encouraged Liz Robbins to write A Race Like No Other, 26.2 Miles Through the Streets of New York. Liz Robbins joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau, which is appropriate, I think. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill. Happy to be here.
A lot of your book concerns the 2007 New York Marathon, but you're interested in the history of the race as well. Is it fair to say that no individual was more responsible for the success of the race than Fred Lebow?
Exactly. He was the one who started the race in 1970, and ever since it became a five-borough race in 1976, he was the marathon's tireless promoter. And so many other cities followed the model, thanks to Fred's passion and his involvement around the world with running groups in other cities wanting to duplicate what he did.
It is fair to say, though, that the race as we will see it tomorrow bears little resemblance to the race Fred Lebow had in mind when he invented it, right?
Oh, that's true. In 1970, it was run in Central Park, and only 127 runners started that four-lap race. And then in 1976, for the first five-borough race, it was 2,090 people, and now it's close to 39,000 people. But his idea is still the same, running through the big cities. He didn't want to bring people to the race like other sporting events. He wanted to bring the race to the people.
During the early years of the New York Marathon, once it had moved out of Central Park, there were various people who were not pleased with the spectacle. Tell me about some of the neighborhoods where the race wasn't entirely welcome and what the organizers had to do to change that.
Well, actually, the Williamsburg section, the ultra-Orthodox section, which is about mile 10 in Brooklyn, is still not all that thrilled to have runners scantily clad going through, as one rabbi put it to me, the shtetl. Certainly, it's a very insular community, and a lot of immodesty does not go over very well. But Fred, of course, came from an Orthodox background in Romania, and when he was alive, he would shout from the pace car a lot of Yiddish words to get people involved. And he'd shout, Wasser, Wasser, you know, trying to get people to bring water to the runners. And I think his efforts made it almost acceptable. And I think that community is a little bit, I wouldn't say involved, but understands that that's what's going to happen on the first Sunday of November.
With all the excellent competitors you had to write about in this book, I couldn't help wondering why you felt you had to include the story of Katie Holmes.
Well, you notice I don't actually have a quote from her. What I did, and I don't want to give away the ending because that's one of my favorite parts. I do talk about her crossing the line, but the people who cross around her are even more special to New York, and they take the limelight. But I think it's an indication that marathon running has included not only the regular people, but the celebrities. And as I say, on this day, the ordinary people feel like celebrities, and the celebrities feel the pain of the ordinary people.
I'm talking with Liz Robbins, author of A Race Like No Other. You're listening to Only a Game. At one point in A Race Like No Other, you discuss a woman who's jogging along, chatting on her cell phone at the same time. This drives some of the other competitors crazy, and it certainly strikes me as a little strange, but I'm sure it's not the strangest thing that you've seen while covering this race.
I have seen a lot of strange things. The Chewbacca costume was certainly entertaining, if not a little sweat-inducing just looking at this runner. The cell phone incident is a little scary because it's become a trend more so to have people wearing headphones. That's actually a USA Track and Field rule that prohibits headphones, but it's so hard to enforce that rule with 39,000 people. But cell phones, much like when you're driving, I think it is a distraction to the people around you, especially when you're just saying, oh yeah, I'm out for a run. Oh, what's new with you? Of course, people in costumes, at any point, you just have to stop and say, why?
You make an excellent case in the book that this marathon is distinctive, crossing five bridges and going through all five boroughs. But I'm wondering, where does the New York City Marathon rank among the world's best marathons, London, Tokyo, Boston, Chicago, whichever, with the runners themselves, the most competitive runners?
It is a very different marathon when you're comparing it to, say, London or Berlin or Chicago. Because it is not flat. You're not going to break a world record. So Haile Gebrselassie broke the world record in Berlin, but it was such a flat course, and he also didn't have a lot of competition. New York is, I would say, the most regarded race, along with Boston, but Boston is in the spring, and I would say that New York, for the way it treats its athletes and brings together the best field and also the championship feel of racing, you get, you know, eight guys who could win this race or five women who could win this race this year. Makes it very exciting. And even though you're not going to break a world record, the challenge of going over these hills in this incredible course, 2 million spectators actually lining the course, it really is a race like no other.
Liz Robbins is the author of A Race Like No Other, 26.2 miles through the streets of New York, published by Harper. She spoke with me from NPR studios in New York. Liz, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
We started swinging at Chili's, then we split to P.J. Clark's, on to Chuck's Composite, then a drink at the start. We won't get home until morning, 'cause we're gonna take a walk on the sidewalks of New York.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon. The world of news encompasses a multitude of subjects, which is why Ron Rappaport often joins me to talk about sports on Weekend Edition. You can also count on Weekend Edition to bring you political, business, and cultural news from around the non-sports world. Join Ron and me for Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
In an apparent attempt to stand the cliché high-speed chase on its ear, on Monday, five Australian lads between the ages of 10 and 16 provoked a low-speed chase. According to police on Australia's North Territory, the boys made their way into a resort in the city of Darwin and stole a golf buggy, which they proceeded to drive down a major road. Two resort employees and police, manfully trying to stifle their giggles, gave chase along the Stuart Highway, but apparently their laughter overcame them. They were only able to catch the 10-year-old, while the four other boys escaped on foot at a rate of speed considerably greater than what they'd managed to achieve in the stolen golf buggy. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on the program, Only a Game's fearless Karen Given risks an encounter with the undead, unarmed. Well, not entirely unarmed. She had a shotgun microphone. Anyway, first I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Please join me in congratulating the Philadelphia Phillies, Charlie. Otherwise, all our listeners who are fans of that team will write again to complain that we were all rooting for the Rays.
This was a very impressive demonstration of ensemble cyber whining that we got from the Philly fans. Hey, you all won. Have a great parade. Now go figure out what the hell's wrong with the Eagles.
This World Series was remarkable, not just because the Phillies won it, but because the bookies in Las Vegas paid off even before Game 5 was over. How'd that happen?
Well, at least they paid off on the right team, because there was a real debacle coming down the tracks if the Rays had managed to get apparently, according to the rules under which you gamble on baseball, if not necessarily play it, if a game gets delayed the way the last game of the World Series did, it reverts to the previous score. Mm-hmm. Therefore, by their lights, the Phillies won the last game of the World Series a day before they actually did.
2-1 in five innings, absolutely. Here's another interesting thing about the series. The umpires have acknowledged that they, like a lot of the people in the country who own television sets, weren't watching the games. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, they admitted that twice in 2 days they admitted that they missed a call in the World Series. I wonder, of course, if this had been a slightly more competitive World Series and these calls had meant a little bit more, whether or not we'd be quite so open-minded about admitting our mistakes.
Greg Oden, either the best or the second-best player in last year's NBA draft, missed his entire rookie season after knee surgery. This week, he finally made his pro debut. Do you think he wishes that maybe he hadn't?
Certainly. If not the best draft pick they ever had, certainly the unluckiest. He sprained his foot. He's going to miss a month, maybe, over this now. And, of course, this has enormous resonance in the history of the Portland Trailblazers, because not only did they suffer through these similar woes by Sam Bowie, who was the player they famously took instead of Michael Jordan, but this goes all the way back to what happened to Bill Walton.
Absolutely.
There's something wrong with feet in Portland. Has anyone figured that out?
Elsewhere on the NBA injury front, Monte Ellis of the Golden State Warriors said this week that the torn ankle ligament he recently suffered was his own fault. Any gray area on this one?
No, not only that, but he lied to his team, probably to avoid the embarrassment. He said that rather than admitting that he was injured in a severe moped accident, he said he got hurt playing in a pickup game.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow riding mopeds violates the league's uniform player contract. The Warriors suspended him for a month. It's going to cost him $3 million. Man, if you're going to get suspended for a month and get socked for $3 million, buy a real motorcycle.
Yeah, when think of all the mopeds you could buy for $3 million, that's a lot. The NBA announced a venue for its 2010 All-Star game this week. Dallas, good locale, right?
Yeah, football stadium. How about that? They're going to put 100,000, plenty of good seats available, 100,000 of them, in fact. The line between what is an indoor and an outdoor stadium now is hopelessly blurred. The NCAA Final Four this year is going to be at the new football stadium in Detroit. You know, if the roof opens and closes, you can have an outdoor-indoor stadium behaving like one.
In the deja vu all over again department, guess which college men's basketball team is ranked number one in the preseason polls?
That would be the North Carolina Tar Heels if I had
indeed.
Tyler Hansbrough back for another year, believe it or not. Kansas, of course, won last year but lost three players to the draft. Memphis was in the championship game last year. Derrick Rose is now playing for the Chicago Bulls. Elsewhere in the top 10, things are pretty standard, although Purdue is ranked number 10 and has not been ranked that highly in a long time.
So I assume you think UNC is, in fact, a legitimate number one pick at this point.
I think at this point, yeah, considering what happened to the other two competitors from last year.
Mike Singletary, the new San Francisco 49ers coach, reportedly underscored his displeasure with the way his team was playing against Seattle last weekend by dropping his pants. Did he nick that move from the late Vince Lombardi?
I have no idea, but I think that dropping your drawers is definitely the universal symbol for disapproval. I can't think of a context in which dropping your pants would be a sign of approval. Oh, wait, I can't think of one. Yeah. So let's move on.
Let's move right on. I know you've been known to enjoy Monday Night Football from time to time. Will you risk viewing the Washington-Pittsburgh game scheduled for this coming Monday evening? And if not, why not?
First of all, I wasn't even aware you knew there was a phenomenon called Monday Night Football. I'm telling you, you are moving on up in the world of sports commentary, if you even recognize its existence. Yes, the two presidential candidates will be popping on the night before the election. Chris Berman will be involved in interviewing them.
Yeah, that's the part that scares me.
Yeah, that's the terrifying part because you can see it coming. Back, 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 Barack!
In college football, today's Florida-Georgia tilt is already wreaking havoc in Georgia. Why is that?
Because people are incredibly stupid and neat lives. In Clark County in Georgia, which includes the home of the University of Georgia, they're going to cancel school because they can't get enough teachers to come to school on Friday because they're all going to the football game. Apparently last year, 137 teachers called in sick the day before the Florida game, which is this Saturday.
Former sprinter Marion Jones told Oprah Winfrey this week that she believes she would have won 5 Olympic medals without doping. So the next question for Ms. Jones should be easy, right?
That's why they call it dope, Bill.
Mm.
I don't believe a word of that, by the way, but you know, she's completed a 6-month prison term. I think the big mistake, Marion, was lying to the feds. That's the big mistake. That's what landed you in the hoosegow. So I think we best deal with the lying to the feds part of your story first.
According to an internal U.S. Olympic Committee email obtained by USA Today, China's government created a list of U.S. athletes likely to cause trouble at the 2008 Summer Games. I don't know about you, but I was troubled to learn that one of those athletes is a golfer. They don't play golf at the Olympics.
Yeah, this continues to have been a wonderful idea, putting the Olympics there on so many different levels. I like that the soccer player Abby Wambach said that it was a great honor to be put on a list because of the stand she's taken in opposition to what's going on in Darfur. Good for Abby.
And finally, Charlie, in some places, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. In Avella, Pennsylvania, when the going got tough, the football team suited up a cheerleader. How'd that work out for them?
Well, they didn't win the game. They didn't come close to winning the game. In fact, they got the everlasting aspirations knocked out of them. They suited up Anastasia Barr, the captain of the cheerleading team, very tiny high school, down to 13 healthy players at the time. And not only that, but some of them took off the pads and went up and played at the band at halftime. I'm telling you, you've got to really want a football team to go through this.
I like the fact that Anastasia made a tackle.
Of course she did. You go ahead and you try to outrun somebody who tumbles for a living.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
And the number one threat to America, zombies.
Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert recently summed up the sport that has been, well, creeping up on college campuses this Halloween week, and his description was surprisingly accurate.
According to Monday's The USA Today, the hottest new trend sweeping college campuses is humans versus zombies, a complex game of tag pitting humans armed with Nerf guns versus the zombies trying to tag them.
What more is there to say about humans versus zombies? Only a Game's Karen Given was on hand for the conclusion of a recent game at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she has our report.
You know, go thriller? Everybody check your walkie-talkie. Make sure you're on channel 21.
Yes, I am. 21.
Darren Twofeathers, Tim Bain, Sean Coffel, and Alex Silver gather in the UMass Student Union 2 hours before the start of the final mission of the fall HVZ. They are humans versus zombies administrators and experts in obscure zombie movies, tying square knots, and, in the case of Tim Bain, Nerf weaponry.
This is the Maverick. It's actually the most common Nerf gun. It's cheap. It's like $6-$7. You see it a lot. It's kind of cool to see what people do with different guns. There's so many guns, though.
Humans versus zombies plays out like any number of popular movies. Zombies try to tag or bite humans to turn them into more zombies. Humans fend off the zombies using Nerf weapons, clean socks, and fresh marshmallows. Zombie players must bite a human every 3 days or they'll starve to death. So Sean Coffel says they stalk humans in parking lots, outside dining halls, and between classes.
You know, I come out of French class with Tim. And we'll just be walking along by the Fine Arts Center, and we'll look off in the distance and see three zombies booking it after a human who's chucking socks over their shoulder as they go, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you hear people who aren't even playing go, yeah, go human, and it's just great.
This semester, the game started with nearly 650 humans. About 25 were turned into zombies right away. Over the course of the next 11 days, all but 200 of the players have been turned to zombies, and all but 100 of those zombies have died of starvation. But Darren Twofeather says all the zombies will be resurrected for today's final mission.
You know, you see in all the zombie movies, tons of zombies and a few humans trying to fight their way out, and the humans that legitimately make it this far without cheating and have been struggling this whole time, using vaccines to stay human and fighting for, you know, their own survival, have really enjoyed the challenge. So they don't mind that there may be 200 zombies to their 10 humans. They are going to try their best to survive.
Oh, yeah. There are vaccines, too, which can shield humans from a zombie bite or turn a zombie back into a human. Almost everything in this game is borrowed from somewhere else. The zombies are of the quick-moving, bloodthirsty variety found in 28 Days Later. They're created by an experiment overseen by the Lazarus Corporation, a thinly veiled knockoff of the Dharma Initiative from the TV show Lost, and there are even nods to Charlton Heston's The Omega Man. But Keith Rood says even though the plot is not exactly original, the outcome of today's final battle is far from predetermined.
I guess since there's no real zombie invasion, you can't exactly say what would really happen and who should be winning.
We try to say there's no winner in the game, but I guess if you look at most zombie movies, it ends with everybody's dead.
With just an hour to go before the final mission, the game admins scatter to four distant corners of the campus to set up their props. The weather, which started off mild, turns dark and windy. On top of O Hill, between two large water towers, Tim Bain gets ready for the 4 o'clock start. To the casual observer, the mission objective looks like a wooden crutch jury-rigged to a slightly smelly trash can. But to human players Jason Mellon and Michael Reardon, it represents an overload switch at a cooling tower.
They've got four of these contraptions around campus, and the different humans have to go around each of them and hold down the lever for 5 minutes, and that's supposed to trigger the reaction. Try to take the zombies out and let the humans live.
If we fail, the virus will spread into the jet stream, and then, like, everyone will become a zombie. It'll be a huge breakout. I never knew UMass Amherst would be such an important site.
While Michael has enjoyed meeting his fellow players, fleeing from zombies hiding in bushes, and learning the ins and outs of Nerf weaponry, there's one component of humans versus zombies the freshman has yet to embrace.
I actually haven't used socks because I find that socks have sentimental value to me. So if I throw them, I'm going to want to retrieve them.
Michael might soon rethink his no-sock policy as a swarm of zombies approach the humans amassed on top of O Hill. Squad leaders call for the humans to hold their line while the zombies approach. As the zombies are hit by flying Nerf darts and socks, they move red bandanas from around their heads to around their necks to indicate that they've been stunned. Human players tagged by zombies move their bandanas from around their arms to their heads to indicate that they've been turned. A full flank of humans fall to the zombies, but before long, the horde is defeated and the mission objective is reached.
Next location, Zeds!
Webster, form up!
While the humans regroup and the zombies fan out to find more victims, HVZ admin Darren Twofeathers hops into his car to try to beat everyone down the hill for the next stage of the scenario.
They managed to start the meltdown, so now they've got to get to the camp center, which is where we're headed right now.
So what's in it for the zombies now? I mean...
Nothing. They want brains. They got a nice feast of brains.
A room in the basement of the campus center serves as the fallout shelter for the surviving human players. Liz Crothers' skin is flushed and she can barely breathe, but she's glad she made it to safety.
Yeah. Asthma attack and all, we made it. It was a little tense for a while. We got to the parking lot behind O Hill, started to go down the hill, and then we caught up with another group of humans. And then from behind us, there was zombies in the parking lot, zombies in the parking lot. So we basically sprinted here from O Hill.
Yay, you're alive!
After 15 minutes, the door to the room is closed, and everyone outside is considered lost, either to the zombie horde or to the radiation released to eliminate the rage virus. While most players celebrate their own survival, a few mourn their fallen classmates.
Jesse didn't make it in!
And we lost Danielle.
We lost the pit crew, we lost Casey, we lost Jesse.
Pit crew had 15 kids, there are two here.
Daryl McTague is a junior who's been playing this game since it first came to UMass 3 semesters ago. He considers this installment to be a success.
Overall, I mean, we did blow up the Pioneer Valley.
But we won.
It's melting right now.
If the game were real, the humans would now be locked in this basement, waiting for the radiation to clear. But since it's only a game, Brian Rizza and Charlie Amonte are headed out for a celebratory feast at the Worcester Dining Commons.
We finally get to feast on Worcester.
It's usually completely overrun by zombies because they like to camp out the dining halls because that's where all the humans have to go to eat. So humans have been staying away from there for the past week or so. So now that we're free and we don't have to look over our shoulders, we can actually eat at the dining halls instead of scrounging for what food we have in our room. So
ramen noodles,
it's a
baby.
Feast. It really, truly is.
No more noodles or shit for your tea.
While campus-wide games of tag have been going on for decades, Humans vs. Zombies was first created just 3 years ago at Goucher College near Baltimore. Today, the game is played on dozens of campuses from California to Maine and as far away as Australia and Brazil. And organizers are happy to say the zombie horde appears to still be spreading.
You got 2 minutes left till you're unstun! 3 minutes left in the barrel!
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Erica Bailey and from Glenn Alexander. Special thanks to super sub Jim Kiesling. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you dare to view Karen Given's Humans vs. Zombies photo gallery, or you want to download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from UMass freshman Jason Mellon.
It's funny to go to Walmart and we, like, 7 college students bring, like, Nerf guns up to the register and, like, are you playing HVZ? Yes, we are.
And while you're at it, ring up these DVDs, okay? I got Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, Returning to the Living Dead, and The Death of the Dead, or something like that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.